Hi, everyone. Welcome back to yet another episode of the Palisades podcast under COVID-19 lockdown. Since the last time we all came to you, Steve and I have advanced a little bit. Last time we were all virtual. Today, Steve and I can actually see each other through glass. How's it going, Steve?
Doing fine. Hanging in there. I don't know what day it is anymore, but I'm alive and breathing and the weather's beautiful and the traffic's nothing, so things are good.
And here we are back at Village Studios, the historic place in West LA that's on Butler. If anybody feels like driving by and taking a look at the building, it is quite unbelievable. It's a sight to behold. It really does look like a piece of history.
It does on the inside. From the outside, you can't tell, but on the inside, there's gold and platinum albums from every rock and roll band and star you've ever heard of is there. It feels like we're just living my youth again by just seeing everything that's been done here.
Your youth, huh? You're dating yourself.
Yeah, yeah. I am. No one else will.
I think it actually looks really great from the outside, too. It's got like a bell. It looks like a drive-by, folks, if you can. All right, so today we're particularly thrilled to be able to talk to Nick Melvoin and Allison Holdorf. So you're all listening because this is the Palisadian podcast. Allison is a lifelong Palisadian. She raised four kids in the Palisades. She was the president of the Palisades High School Board of Trustees, and she actually ran against the person who is now our school board member, Nick Melvoin. But they were like-minded, and eventually they kind of merged their campaigns and helped each other. And now they're a duo. They're an unbeatable team that's definitely leading LAUSD into the future. So we're thrilled to have them both. We've got Allison and Nick with us. Nick is, as you all know, the District 4 representative on the LAUSD school board, but he's also the vice president of the board. He was elected in May of 2017, and he informs us that that was exactly 3 years ago on Saturday. So, Nick, tell us how it's going for these last 3 years.
Well, thank you. It's so nice to be here and love that I'm joined with Allison. As you said, I think we were both in a primary together running against what we thought was a failing sclerotic system, and then have been working together since I got elected. So it's been 3 years since the election and 3 years of partnership and friendship with Allison, but hard to believe. And, you know, in terms of just kind of a battle-tested, weather-worn tenure, you know, since being on the board, we've had a board member resign after being indicted, a superintendent retire, a superintendent search, the first teacher strike in 30 years, wildfires that have closed schools, and now a global pandemic.
So oh my goodness.
I'm definitely getting my money's worth.
It's been uneventful, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Just your normal time on the LA Unified Board.
Well, I'm sure all of your degrees help prepare you for this.
Yes. This is one of the things. It's torts, contracts, and then how to survive a pandemic. It was the first semester.
Those were your classes. Allison, what's it like? I mean, you came to education from the point of view of a mom. You raised three kids. You went through the public school system. You know, through all the years that you were in that system, you saw it change. You were not impressed with the fiscal management of the school system. And you finally decided to run, but not as a politician, as a community mom. Tell me what it looks like now from the inside.
Well, I could not be happier. Let me start with that. Being Nick's senior advisor and district director, overseeing around 130 of our schools, Nick is amazing to work with. Having served on Pali High's board for 6 years and being involved in the negotiations and understanding the intricacies and the important factors that go into being a good board member, I would say that Nick's true to his own self and he sees the things through the kids' lens. I also had a law degree from way back, and once I had kids, kind of put that in the back seat to focus on education and in the Pali complex. But definitely the fiscal issues that you could see, the mismanagement of funds and making promises to retirees and all of that was frustrating. And I have to say, Nick is one of the very few board members to focus solely on that through the kids' lens, making sure that the monies are closest to the classroom for improvements. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, I'm going to make you talk more about being a mom on the inside. But Nick, you taught at an inner city Markham
middle school,
right? It was in Watts. And you were a soccer and baseball coach. You helped your students start a school newspaper, which I can attest to the fact that school newspapers are very enriching. You know, I managed the school newspaper for one of my kids' elementary schools, and, you know, it was like an afternoon class, and these kids would come in clueless. And by the end of the year, they were truly curious minds that would go out there and ask questions and write articles. And, you know, I really sort of went through those years feeling like some of these kids had a light bulb that lit for them and that they might go on and keep an eye on journalism as a future. And I imagine that at Markham Middle School, that was even more pronounced.
Oh, for sure.
It was the finances. It was the way that finances were managed because a whole bunch of teachers alongside you lost their jobs during budget cuts. Is that, how was that as you looked through your lens at that particular school in that particular place in this particular city and noticed how mismanagement of a budget can really impact lives?
Yeah, well, it's really relevant now. And as we're staring, you know, down into the abyss of a looming recession as a result of COVID, you know, that's what really launched me into the school board, was that I was right out of college. I, like you said, started teaching at a middle school in Watts, 104th in Compton, right next to the Watts Towers. And I had the good fortune of starting to teach in 2008. And so when the last recession hit, the district had huge budgetary holes, and the way we lay off teachers in this city and state is based on seniority, and most of these more junior teachers are at harder to staff schools. And so not only did I lose my job, but 70% of our staff lost their jobs. And so I went the summer unemployed, came back to a school that had been decimated, worked as a substitute, and then got rehired. But it really opened up my eyes to, you know, one of the things Allison was saying, which is that decisions weren't made with the kids first mentality, because if they were, you wouldn't fire 70% of teachers at a school where 100% of kids are living in poverty.
So how long, Nick, was it that you were a teacher before you decided to get involved in administration? I mean, how did that come about?
Yeah, so my first year I was a teacher, and like Miriam said, started a soccer team, a baseball team, the newspaper. I was an editor-in-chief of my middle school and high school newspaper, and thought it was really important that kids, especially my struggling readers and writers, like had something to motivate them and be inquisitive. So I got laid off. I came back in the fall of 2009. And like I said, the school had been decimated. And so I actually reached out to the ACLU. I had not gone to law school yet, but I said, this system either is illegal or should be illegal or is unconstitutional. The fact that these kids who need teachers and counselors and nurses the most aren't getting them. And so we filed a lawsuit. I said that they filed a lawsuit. I was not yet an attorney, on behalf of my students, called Reed versus California. Sherelle Reed was one of my eighth graders. And it argued that seniority-based layoffs that disproportionately impact poor students of color were unconstitutional in California. And we won. We settled that case. We protected it at a moratorium of 50 lower-income schools. And so that really catalyzed my interest in law school, having worked with the ACLU. And so I got laid off again because the case had settled, but after I got my second pink slip, as we call it, and so decided to you know, use that opportunity to go to law school. Came back, started organizing parents again around education reform, started teaching at LMU, where I had done my master's at night when I was teaching, and that's what connected me to parents and kind of the tackling the problems of LA Unified as an advocate and as an attorney, and then got cajoled really into running for the school board, you know, in 2017.
So I, as a lawyer myself, who's been doing it for a lot longer than you, I am astounded by your career. Here you are, 2008, you start out as a high school teacher, and you then get involved, you go to law school, you work for the U.S. Attorney's Office, you come back, you run for the school board, you're on the school board, and all that took place in 12 years. It was like, did you foresee this happening? Were you planning it, or it just life got in the way of what you're planning?
Well, thank you for that. No, you know, I was a victim of circumstance. I really wanted to teach. You know, I graduated in June of 2008 on the cusp of the Obama era. And so I was really passionate about service. I had loved working with kids. I run a nonprofit camp called Camp Harmony, which takes about 330 homeless and underserved kids in LA and takes them to a camp experience. We used to run it out of Camp Hess Kramer up in Malibu. That burned down. So we've been renting other sites. And now this year, because of COVID, we don't know what we're going to do. But so I wanted to come back to LA and teach. And I thought that I would teach and then maybe do school administration, become a principal. And it wasn't really until I got laid off and then got involved in this advocacy that I thought more about public policy. In many ways, when I got laid off, I became kind of the poster child for this inane system, because I just graduated from Harvard. I was trying to teach in Watts and I kept getting laid off. And so when we brought this lawsuit, the mayor, then Villaraigosa, came and we did a press conference. Then Governor Schwarzenegger flew down to our school to do a press conference, because everyone was like, this can't be the way that the system works. And so I went up to Sacramento. I testified at the Senate Education Committee about what was happening in schools. And so that's when it really opened my eyes to this broader world outside of the classroom that affects what's happening in the classroom.
Took 3 years off and went to law school.
So took 3 years off, went to law school. But still, that first summer was back in LA at the ACLU working on education litigation. Second summer was working in the Obama White House, doing on the team called Justice and Regulatory Policy, which was the liaison with the DOJ. So was always still connected to schools and kids, just trying to figure out the best path to tackle it.
That is an amazing story, impressive. Nick. Yeah, it really is. So I've got two questions to ask you. One is present, one is about the past. Is that not how it goes anymore? Layoffs in LAUSD are no longer based on seniority. Is there another yardstick that you use? Does it have anything to do with performance?
So unfortunately, well, we won the case and we settled. It protected these 50 schools that are still protected, but LA Unified has 1,000 schools. And so there was another lawsuit that I was involved with, really just as an advocate, and I testified, called Vergara versus California, that looked at ending seniority. And it won at the superior court level and then got overturned. So the district, you know, what we're thinking about now is trying to be more creative. There's something in California law called skipping criteria. So if a teacher has a specific skill set, they have a dual language certification, then we can skip them so that they can stay at a certain school. And so what we've been working on is trying to make sure that our teachers are really high performing teachers. Our teachers at hard to staff schools have these extra certificates. Mm-hmm. But we're also, Miriam, working right now to try to prevent and inoculate the district from any layoffs in the first place. Like Allison said, one of the things I've been working on since I got here, with Allison's advice and counsel and help, of course, is the long-term liabilities, healthcare and pensions. And last year, for example, working with our unions, we were able to move retirees who are eligible for Medicare over to Medicare and save about $50 million a year for the district. And so there's a lot of savings, I think, that we can start to realize if we make these hard decisions now that will protect teaching positions. And so that's where I'm at. You know, we have a board meeting tomorrow and I'll be starting this drumbeat of there are things the district can do before laying off teachers, and that has to be a last resort.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you is nobody has any love lost or particularly wants to defend teachers who don't perform well and have to stay anyway. But the reality is that these are people who've been teaching for a lifetime. When you lay teachers off, you have to make sure that they have a way to live, that there's still an income coming in, or there's a retirement plan or something. You can't just like release people into the street and say, well, go deal with it. You've served our school for 20 years and, you know, new people are coming, so see you later. And it's great that there's a cognizance of that you certainly do need to have new talent coming in. I've seen it over and over again that, you know, I'm sure you were one of those teachers. You were kind of new. You had ideals that matched up really well with the kids you were teaching. You had fresh ideas. You had the energy to implement them. And it was important to have you in there. But it was also important to take care of some of the older teachers that, you know, necessarily needed to cycle out. I want to ask you about Harvard. I think people generally believe going to Harvard means that you have an inherent interest in public policy. Did you, or did it just kind of evolve, or does Harvard sort of prepare you to look at things on a broad scale and think of public policy?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I mean, it's a little like Frank Capra-esque or cliche, but there, my freshman dorm, there was this gate right next to it that said, when you walk into Harvard Yard, it said, enter to grow in wisdom. And on the other side of the gate, it says, to depart to better serve thy country and thy kind. And I remember being a wide-eyed 18-year-old and being like, that's the purpose of education. Like, you know, grow wisdom and go to serve. And so I did my summer after my freshman year, I was back in LA working for a congressman. I was also working at the Apple store as a genius at the promenade. So I was getting I'm ready for this digital learning because of the my Apple genius credentials. But and I did spend time in college working on various political campaigns and actually teaching. I did a program called Civics, where you taught in inner city schools civics education. It's actually a program. He graduated the year before I got there, but Pete Buttigieg, Mayor Pete, did this program.
No way.
So we have mutual friends from our teaching days. But
very cool.
But yeah, you know, I did think that it was especially at that era, you know, 2008, the dawn of the Obama era, that I did think that, you know, especially having grown up in the west side of LA, grown up in Brentwood, played soccer at AYSO every Saturday at Paul Revere, and just having seen what how powerful education can be, being the great grandson of immigrants and having that kind of quintessential American story. So it was always important to me to find a way to be of service.
So let me jump in, because when Miriam was asking that question, I'm looking at her and my mouth was kind of hanging open. That was my reaction about people going to Harvard are looking for public service and for the betterment of mankind and so forth. I once visited Harvard as a tourist. If I had applied, they would have laughed at my application. But I don't have that impression of Harvard. And this is just as purely as an outsider. My impression of people going to Harvard is that they want to make it in the world.
Yeah.
They want to get wealthy. They want to get ahead. Maybe along the way do some good. But I don't have it in my mind as a place where do-gooders go to save the world.
Yeah.
You want me to chime in on that?
Go ahead, Nick. What's the answer?
No, I think it's true. And I remember our like convocation when I was graduating by the president of the university then, who was the first female president of Harvard, was about how most of my class, I mean, I did Teach for America, which was a popular kind of, you know, graduate program. But most of my friends were going to consulting, to banking, and you know, I remember I had an advisor that was just paired with me, who was like the Harvard class of 52. And, you know, thinking about his class and all the people who'd gone into service, whether that was military service or teaching, or and then my class, where a lot of people were going to Wall Street and consulting. I think you do see that in the excesses of my generation, too. I mean, a guy who was a few years ahead of me at Harvard was, you know, Jared Kushner. So say no more.
No way. No way. All right. So, you know what? I guess my perspective comes from that of a parent. I had a kid who applied to Harvard and all she wanted to do was change the world. And when we kind of dug, and Allison, I'll bring you in on this, because when we dug a little bit deeper to figure out who, not only who applies, but who gets into Harvard, we realized that Harvard actually reaches really far, like out into the third world, where they try to find people who might instigate change, you know, might have the impetus to look for and be the agent for change around the world. And that's funny, because, that's what I think of Harvard as, like, people who make change. Allison, what's it like to sit in the Palisades and watch your kids go through school and apply to college and go and be successful and move on? How's that?
It was a pretty unbelievable experience. And I have to say, even in elementary school, my kids brought the inner city to us. So I didn't grow up in the Palisades myself. I grew up and not from a lot of means. And we just bought at the right time 25 years ago. And I remember Alex bringing home a fourth and fifth grader who were from the Rampart Division at Pali Elementary. And I was driving them to the aquarium. And Ozzy was talking about how his parents were both dead and he was raised by his grandmother and didn't have any help at all with school. And that was a moment in time where I had to explain to my three kids that, you know, people have very different backgrounds. And that's the one thing I do like about Revere, with 2,100, 1,000 who are living in poverty, the same for Pali High, that they had that more integrated experience on a socioeconomic level when you consider the wealth that's in the Palisades. I will say that service was emphasized every step of the way, including all of the parents, right? Because we wouldn't have art, music, tech, nothing, but for the booster clubs and these governing boards that are allocating that. And actually, when Nick was being laid off, my kids' teachers were also being laid off, right? And so, but we could struggle and try to help them. It's interesting where my kids have landed. My daughter is getting her master's in Amsterdam at the moment. She was here for the last 2 months. She's leaving on Wednesday, but wants to give, doing shark conservation and all different kinds of things. And the other two are very much involved in activities like that through music and photography. So I feel like they were very blessed. But I do think that the schools on the west side, a lot of people think that they don't need a lot of help, and they do get a fair amount of help from the parents and the boosters. But we have schools in Westchester, West LA. I think one of the highest homeless rates is at Uni High, for example. And there is a fair amount of poverty in the, our Westchester schools, most of which are Title I. And so there's a lot of resources out there. And I think Pally High and Revere do a phenomenal job of emphasizing service and having kids do all types of projects that lead them into giving.
Well, Miriam, I just have to, if I can chime in, because there's a little story that connects college, Pally, and Allison's children. And that is that last summer, I got a call from a friend of mine from college who was working for Elon Musk, and they had just built this underwater submarine to try to rescue the kids in the cave in Thailand, the soccer, but they hadn't yet tested it. And so they needed a pool to test it. So they called me on Saturday night. I was at a wedding. I called Allison. They opened the Palisades High pool. They tested this. Allison's son, who's an underwater photographer, was there documenting the whole thing. Then they sent it off to Thailand to help with the rescue. So
that is amazing. I do remember that story. I do remember the Elon Musk Palisades High School pool tie-in. I had no idea, Allison, that your son has those historic pictures, which we will obviously be asking you to share. But that's very cool. I didn't realize that. I was going to say I had a discussion once on NPR about on a segment having to do with education, and you know, I was there kind of talking about West Side schools, and there were other parents there talking about how their schools are underfunded and under-resourced. And I remember saying somewhat what you were just saying, Allison, that, you know, yes, those parents go out and we raise a decent amount of money, but we put it back into enrichment in these schools that happen to bring in kids from a pretty wide range of zip codes. So, like, as you say, at Paul Revere Middle School, there are 2,000 kids, and we bring kids in from 99 different zip codes around Los Angeles. And that's a pretty, you know, diverse landmass there. A few years ago, we raised a good amount of money. I remember it was a good year. And so we thought we'd be able to park some money aside and call it this like emerging project, a legacy project that we'd be able to launch a digital classroom where we could offer connectivity to every kid, not just here locally, but to connect them to schools across the globe so that, you know, an American kid here in Brentwood could see how an Indian kid learns across the globe. So that project kind of, you know, went and it didn't go and had fits and starts. And obviously we had other needs and, you know, money got pulled. So fast forward to today where digital learning is essential, right? Nobody's in school. Nobody's in a classroom. If you can't connect, you cannot learn. What can you guys do? I mean, I know you've got a lot to think about right now as you watch 600,000 kids across this massive school district be at home. But what is it that you guys can do right now to make sure, at least here in the States, the digital divide shrinks a little bit and kids have access to technology that can help them learn?
Well, I'm happy to let Allison start because she's actually been on the ground making sure that our schools, you know, 130 that we represent, have the technology they need, the devices, the hotspots, and she's been conversing with principals and parents. And so, Allison, do you want to talk a little bit about the work and the money we've invested to close that digital divide?
Sure. And just as a starting point, Nick, before the pandemic, had a resolution that he was working on to advocate that we become, that every kid has Wi-Fi, that it's a universal right. And that is still something that's coming up on this board meeting. So that kind of sets the stage. As we know, LA Unified was not one-to-one prior to the pandemic. And under Nick's direction, we've become basically one-to-one, distributing over 100,000 devices and hotspots throughout the district. And as district director, we get the calls, we monitor and make sure that all of our schools were lifted. And they started with high school seniors because that was a priority, right? We want them to graduate. And we worked our way all the way down to elementary schools. And at this point, we get very few calls, but we still get them. And if someone doesn't have a hotspot or a digital device, we make sure that it's in their hand. Through this time, it's been really fascinating because as it is Nick's first year, we visited all 140-150 schools. And that was a big lift for us to do that. Through Zoom now, we're popping in on parent meetings, principal meetings. We converged all of a representative from each of our high schools in Board District 4, and it's actually amazing/exhausting how much we can cover. But what's amazing is the parents, really inspirational. At Loyola Village, for example, we were on a call, a principal's meeting with the parent, and the parent had her arm around her daughter. This is during a parent coffee with the principal, saying, "I'm so thrilled. I've never seen her instruction before, and now I feel like I can really help her in her class." So even though this has been a challenge and a lift, it's also been remarkable in the way that, my goodness, at Emerson Middle School, We had 90 families on a Saturday morning participate. We've never had that in an in-person meeting. So maybe going forward with Revere, for example, we've had a good turnout, but maybe much more families can be listening to the board member, listening to the principal remotely, and then some in person going forward. So it's been great. And the digital divide still exists. There's no doubt. We're loaning these computers to kids. And Nick can take it forward. We're going to be giving it to all the kids and letting them use it throughout the summer because of the gap. And seniors will have to turn it in after their graduation.
I love that. Talk about silver linings. The fact that, and I know we're all searching for silver linings these days, but this is definitely one of them, that the kids learning and that their school day becomes more accessible to the parents. There's definitely a coming together that happens online that can't happen in person because people can't just physically get there. I've noticed it too, and I love it. Nick, the digital divide, it's got to be something that's on your mind. You've seen the way that kids learn. You've seen the disparate nature of learning from people who have and have not. It's got to be on your mind. What do you think?
Yeah, and it goes back to, 12 years ago when I started this newspaper, and the computers, we had very few computers at Markham, and the ones we had didn't have Microsoft Office. So one of the ironies is actually I started my kids on Google Docs because it was the only thing available. And, we were a little ahead of the curve there. But
very nice.
The district, most listeners will remember a few years ago before my time, but the infamous iPad debacle. And I think the district was correct to think about the digital divide before many people were, and trying to get technology in the hands of kids who needed it. But like many problems with LA Unified, this kind of one size fits all, everyone gets an iPad, top-down approach really failed. And so there's still a lot of the scar tissue there where people are really nervous. And so since I've been on the board, we have been inching closer to one device per every child. My office, through Allison, has been funding Chromebook carts, laptops, iPads, and actually a lot of our schools were more prepared than others when our closure hit because we had funded these laptops. But now overnight, the entire system is online. Like Allison said, we've given over 100,000 devices. We've spent a lot of money. And I have this resolution that now the superintendent is just going to take up as a point of advocacy to say to the county, to the state, access to high-speed internet is no longer a luxury, it's a necessity. And so we are filling in the needs of a lot of other government actors by providing the devices and the hotspots. But this was the first time in history the census is digital. And census is online. And then we need everyone to fill out the census. And so we hope to partner to have there are cities in this country, Chattanooga, Tennessee, Madison, Wisconsin, others that have universal Wi-Fi, free access. And we'd like LA to be soon on that list. And we'll continue to provide devices for kids, but I think it's important for other governmental actors to help us when it comes to free access.
So I wanted to follow up on something that I think it was Allison mentioned a couple minutes ago. So for reference, I have three kids all raised in the Palisades, Marquez Elementary. A couple of them went to private schools afterwards, but my kids are now in their 30s. And at the time, my ex-wife and others were involved in trying to get the schools in the Palisades to be charter schools. But at the time, it was helpful in getting the parents involved. It was helpful in getting the community involved in the well-being of the schools. Now, I understand that it's not fair to the communities that can't afford it, don't have the resources and all that. But is there no way to have some type of system to get the parents involved in their local schools, if not a charter school, then something similar where they feel like they really have a stake in getting involved in their kids' educations rather than feeling like the system is just too big and they don't have any control over it?
Yeah. And to clarify, I've been a supporter of charters in the Palisades for that reason, not because there's anything magical about the word charter, but because local control and more community-based decision-making, I think is the way to go. And so one thing that we have been working on, despite the pandemic, is this decentralization plan that we've put in place that I've been interested in since getting elected. And starting in the fall, while we are not sure yet what the physical school reopening will look like, the district is going to be divided into 40 we're calling communities of schools. And each community of school is like its own mini district. And so, for example, the Palisades, Brentwood, and kind of parts of other parts of West LA into Westwood are going to be their own community of schools. They have what's going to be called, or what we're calling, a COSA, a community of schools administrator. It's basically a mini superintendent. And they're going to try to run it as if it's a mini district of 30 schools so that over time, there's less interaction with the huge bureaucracy. And actually, I think I can say this publicly, even though there's no plan yet, but I have been advocating to sell our district headquarters downtown. We own this huge office building downtown. I think not only is it a poor investment for the district, but it's such a symbol of this like central bureaucracy. It almost looks like the Death Star, actually, our headquarters. And so as everybody is working remotely, we've now seen that we don't need this headquarters. And we really want to put people back at schools or in these local communities of schools and really have no central bureaucracy, have a very lean central office. And so this is part of something that has been a priority of mine since getting elected, and we're taking it in phases. But in the fall, the Palisades complex will be in this new communities of schools. The offices will be, Allison, I believe, is it Webster?
Actually, Brentwood Science, exactly.
The Brentwood Science Magnet, right? Which is another great kind of turnaround story that we can talk about or in a future date. There, Brentwood Science's growth in math and English this year was in the 95th percentile. But we're going to, at Brentwood's, at that campus, right, at Gretna Green and San Vicente, there will be the administrators for the West Side schools. So no one has to go downtown. That's where there's going to be the head of maintenance, the head of instruction. We do hope to see a lot more community involvement because people will feel like, oh, this is my neighborhood school, as opposed to I'm part of a 1,200 school.
Wow, you guys, that's...
I love the idea. How do you make sure that the minority, poorer communities have the same access to funds that the wealthier communities have?
Yeah, it's an important question. And actually, we did a pilot of these communities of schools in East and South LA, because to your point, we wanted to say, let's try to make it work there before we go to more affluent communities, the Valley and the West Side. And what we saw is that there's been more partnership with local business and philanthropy because people are excited to fund their neighborhood school. They just don't want to fund LAUSD. And so we see a lot more activity from like local businesses, partnerships with, in some cases, like other cities that are encompass LA Unified, Southgate, West Hollywood, et cetera. To the extent that the district has revamped its philanthropic arm, we have the philanthropic dollars going to those schools. You know, people often remember Mark Zuckerberg gave a $100 million gift to Newark Public Schools. The second largest gift in history to public school district is to Los Angeles Unified, and it's through the Lundquist, the Partnership for LA Schools, $80 million over the last few years. And those schools are all in South and East LA. So the pilot year was with the East and the South communities of schools, Boyle Heights, Angelina Heights. And, you know, once we kind of worked out the kinks, now we're ready in the fall to go district-wide.
That is really cool. That is
amazing.
Truly
yeah.
Revolutionary. Thrilled to hear it. I think it's very smart. And as I said, when we started this, first I was going to say that Zuckerberg donation, Newark, New Jersey, right? So just outside of New York, where amazingly, remarkably, it's kind of like, it's a little bit, you know, comparable to what we go through here in LA. Newark, New Jersey is a town that's completely underserved, has been for generations. And I grew up in New Jersey, you drive 10 miles or 10 minutes out of Newark, New Jersey, and you find some of the most affluent areas in the States. So yeah, quite a comparison and, you know, very much applicable. But what I was going to say, and I think this is kind of what we led in with, you guys have made community interaction, community outreach and interaction and involvement really a cornerstone of your administration. And it has been remarkable. It's been noteworthy. And this idea that you were able to or even articulate enough or bold enough to recognize that big building on that top of hill on Beaudry really is a little bit like the Death Star. And decided to localize school. You know, the biggest critique LAUSD ever gets is that it's the second largest school district in the States, and it's completely impersonal, and it sort of runs on its own without ever touching base with its stakeholders. And you guys have upended that. And I love this idea. I hope you're able to implement it.
And we also, Miriam, too, as part of this, we are going to have community of schools advisory boards. And so the idea, charter schools have their own boards. Allison was on the Pali High board. One of the benefits of that is that local decision-making, that buy-in, and also that kind of neighborhood accountability mechanism. And so we plan to do that with these communities of schools too, so that there will be a group, like there are the neighborhood councils, that would help oversee the schools and then kind of even be a decision-making body. And so then I'd be able to consult with these communities of schools, governing councils, and make decisions that are really in the best interest of each community.
It totally makes sense. You all know I chair something called RAC, and that is what it is. It's this thing that oversees a whole bunch of neighborhood councils in an area. And there are common lines that run within those neighborhood councils, and it makes it easier to reach out into the community and do things that are impactful on the ground. This really sounds great. You guys, I want to ask you about the Palisades sort of charter complex of schools. How are they doing with connectivity? There's how many schools we've got? I think we have like three elementary schools. I could be getting this wrong. We might have four elementary schools, a middle school, and a high school. All those kids are online. How are they doing?
Yeah, and I'll let Allison chime in there too, but I will say, you know, one of our thoughts, particularly these weeks, are going out to our high school seniors. And so we've been working with Pali specifically to not only work on virtual learning, but virtual graduation and celebrating their seniors. But Allison, you want to chime in there about our Pali complex?
Sure. So we have the Pali complex is comprised initially of Topanga, Kenter, Canyon, Marquez, and Pali. Those are the five elementary schools that are affiliated charters that are renewing their charters right now. Then you have Revere, 2100, that's also affiliated. Then you have Pali High, which is an independent. We've also included Brentwood Science in that. So technically you could say there are six elementary schools. And I've been checking on all of them. Nick wants daily, you know, we were monitoring daily. They all have connectivity. They passed out their digital devices. Revere did a remarkable thing. They are the highest throughout the entire district on parents that are participating in Schoology. And Schoology is what how the parents can find out about their kids' assignments, how the kids can find out about their assignments. It's kind of a platform that then you can go to classroom, the Google Classroom, and all the, and using all these other platforms to get assignments. Revere has done a phenomenal job. 3 days before the closure, they made sure that kids came in. They were already one-to-one. Pali High, 3 days after the closure, they opened up class. It was, again, remarkable. And we've highlighted, Nick highlighted, he does virtual town halls every Wednesday on pretty serious matters, and he can talk about that in a bit. And then we have a Friday where he's done cooking classes and mask making, and we highlighted one of the Pali High teachers, Jamie Aegis, who's making using their Makerspace 3D printer, making masks for hospitals. And all the elementary schools have been one-to-one. Even Brentwood Science, that didn't have digital devices and hotspots, maybe struggled a bit more. They all have that. I would say kudos to Nick for really making sure that that happened in short order.
So what happens if, and I well, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe you guys are going to tell us today what day the LA Unified is going to open in the fall, what that exact date will be. But if you're not, what's going to happen if we're still in this situation come August, September? Do you anticipate that it will continue on with classes being done virtually? Do you have any idea what that's going to look like?
Yeah, so we have one. We're doing a really expanded virtual summer school. So for the past, since I've been involved with the district, fewer than 10% of kids have been able to access summer school because of state funding. We're making a virtual summer school program available to 100% of kids. It starts on June 24th. People can go to lusd.net to register, and it's going to have remedial classes. It's going to make sure that there's opportunity for kids to make up what they may have lost over the last few months. There's also some exciting enrichment classes. We're partnering, for example, with James Cameron, director of Titanic, to do a Titanic-themed oceanography marine biology class that's going to be all remote. So that's for June and July. We are reopening August 18th. We've made that announcement. I think what your question is more about is like, what's that going to look like? And we have a task force that meets daily that is looking into those contingencies. You know, we have said, the mayor, for example, Mayor Garcetti said last week on CNN, well, we really can't open schools until we have plenty of tests and we can test kids every week. Well, we don't have access yet to all those tests as the district. And so we're working with the city to say, are you going to allocate funding that we can procure our own tests, or do we have a partnership where any district employees and students get expedited? So we're looking at testing, contact tracing, socially distant classrooms. You know, some kids come one day, some come the next. It really is our plan to open in some physical capacity in the fall, but we know that that's not going to look like quote unquote normal school.
So, Nick, I wonder, are you guys, do you look across the globe to see what other places are doing? I mean, I know there are cities across the globe that have begun to bring kids back to school, but as you say, it doesn't look like it did before. You know, classes are maybe some of them are outside. The day is staggered. Fewer people, fewer kids occupy a room. There's distance. There's, you know, there are ways where people are getting creative. You guys are huge. This is a huge district, but does creativity come into play?
It does. And we're talking with other large districts. I mean, the only ones in our neighborhood really are New York, Chicago. And so we are talking to folks about what they're doing and looking at international examples, you know, whether that's Taiwan or kind of some of the Scandinavian countries.
Yeah.
And that's where I think we're getting some ideas about staggered start, you know, different days. Some districts are looking at just having teachers come back and everything will be streamed remotely, but at least teachers will be in one place. They'll be able to collaborate. They'll be able to do their kind of grade planning. You know, I think we're talking to the state also about procuring more PPE because, you know, we want to make sure that we provide protective equipment to kids and adults. And so a lot of moving pieces, but I do think this is something where creativity comes in. And there is definitely going to be a virtual component because we have employees who are in high-risk categories. And, you know, Allison and my focus is really on parent-based decision-making. And so for parents who are saying, I don't feel comfortable sending my child back, you know, somebody in our household is medically fragile, we're going to be creating alternatives. And so we're not going to force anyone to go back. There's going to be an online component, at least in the short term, so that families can come back at their own pace too. Because I think that this is one where we want to be really sensitive to the needs of each family member.
So you don't anticipate it's going to be a one-size-fits-all school program like it has been for forever. I mean, since I was a kid in the LA Unified and through my kids, I mean, you go to school, you come, you get there a certain time, you go home. You anticipate that some will be coming, some will be going on staggered days, some won't be coming at all. You'll have to adjust.
Yeah, and I think also if we reopen and then there is a case that somebody tests positive a certain school, you know, I foresee us closing that school. Maybe it's a 2-week period, doing a deep clean, but not closing every school. And so there are going to be, you know, these contingencies. But I also think this is one of the opportunities that this pandemic has created, which is, you know, why does there have to be a one size fits all approach? Why can't we have mastery based learning, which we're looking, you know, if you prove that you've mastered calculus, why do you have to stay in the seat for the rest of the year? Can you go on to you know, Calc BC or so. And so I think we're looking at things in the short term, but I hope that some of these creative ideas last beyond the this pandemic.
Yeah. In fact, I was just going to say a couple of years ago, actually inspired by the traffic problem at Paul Revere. But anyway, a couple of years ago, I was doing some research and I read, you know, there were a few articles, not a slew, but a few articles about this idea that for generations, schooling has been done in one sort of cookie cutter way, where people stream into a school, they sit in a room, all of their attention is up front where this, you know, fountain of knowledge is supposed to spew out everything that they know for that year. And then, you know, somehow they know it all and they get to move on. And again, this was a few years ago, no pandemic in sight. But the idea was, what if we were to rethink education? And what if we were to use technology as a tool to do it better? And I mean, all of these conversations were basically non-starters. They were too hard to consider, too tough to implement, you know, no need to change something that seemed to be working. And again, it's kind of interesting if this pandemic makes us rethink education. And, you know, just like Allison or you guys were talking about how people who go to work have suddenly realized that they can be just as productive without actually getting in their car and going to work. So again, it's a terrible time, but maybe a time to rethink some basic things.
I think so. And Allison and I ran at, you know, to disrupt the system. And this pandemic is definitely a disruption. And while it's not one that we anticipated, like, can we use kind of the fact that it's going to make us rethink all these things, you know, like the teacher just standing in front of the classroom and lecturing, or like summer break. I mean, you know, this is still a vestige of the agrarian economy and the, you know, why there's a lot, as we've spoken about, the summer learning loss. And that happens every year. And so now people are more acute to the fact that kids have been out of physical school. And so we need to make up for the lost time. But every summer, kids go on break. You know, 80% of the district are kids who live in poverty. Those kids aren't going to summer camp. They're not getting enrichment. And they're just actually losing some of the content. You know, experts put it at about a month of the school year they lose over the summer and just, you know, forgetting the material. So lots of opportunities.
Yeah, I think we're all trying to find the silver opportunity, silver linings here of going through this horrible experience of, you know, less traffic and not having to travel as much and making better opportunities of working out of homes and not having to go to offices and whatever profession is. So it sounds like you guys are really open to all kinds of possibilities of making this a better situation.
Nick and Allison, both, what do you guys do for the kids who use school for more than just learning? I mean, what about the kids who use it as a place to be safe all day, a place to get food, a place to even, you know, maybe be able to tell about something that's going on at home that needs to be told about? That's not happening.
No, and I'm so glad you brought it up while we're still chatting, because it's, you know, we're running the largest food bank in the country. The district has served over 20 million meals now, which is larger than the whole kind of post-Hurricane Katrina effort in some of those surrounding states. We're serving about 500,000 meals a day. And so that has continued uninterrupted and will through the summer to feed kids. We're using that as an opportunity as a distribution channel for everything from those devices to diapers, feminine products, toys, and really finding ways to get things to our families who need them. We also have our counselors, our nurses, everyone's working remotely. We've set up a mental health hotline that we have been promoting, and we did a town hall out of our office on mental health and resilience. We have for kids who aren't connecting, and it's a now decreasing number, we are doing home visits and finding other ways to meet their needs. We're partnering, you know, still with the county and others on for foster youth for our nearly 18,000 homeless students. I think this is one thing that folks have realized throughout this experience is just the huge role that schools play in the social safety net for families. So as we look, you know, down the pike at budget cuts, we're trying to remind folks in Sacramento and up and down the state that this is not the time to cut schools. This is the time to invest. We're a healthcare provider for many of our families, food, mental health support, and the list goes on.
Yeah. I was going to ask you how the state budget was going to impact the possibilities for you guys. We can have you on in a few months and you can tell us, yeah. But I'm sure it's going to be impactful.
And I'm sure everybody else is saying the same thing, firefighters and law enforcement and mental health, all that stuff. It's a tough time because the economy's in the toilet and people don't have the money to pay more taxes. In fact, their taxes are getting cut. So it's challenging, and it's, for me, it's exciting, and it's great to see two people like you with such open minds there trying to figure out what to do next when the door is wide open and you can go down any path you want.
We're going to wind this up, but I really want to know, how did it go trying to teach people how to make the LAUSD famous coffee cake?
Ah, yeah, that was, I think, by far our, you know, the most fun digital program we've done. It was great. The cafeteria manager at Marina Del Rey Middle School and I did a, you know, virtual Zoom coffee cake class, and I can attest it was as delicious as I remember it and as we've seen it at schools. And I think, you know, this coming Friday, we may be doing round two. The LAUSD is also famous for its chalupas.
Ah, did not know that.
We might be doing a how to make the LAUSD chalupa cooking class. But,
well, that's funny because when breakfast in classroom, another controversial thing, but when breakfast in the classroom came to our schools, I remember parents talking about, well, no, you know, we can't do that. And our kids are eating breakfast. And somebody said, yeah, but the coffee cake. And we were like, okay, maybe the coffee cake.
Maybe the coffee cake, yes. So people can go online to our Facebook page, and it's a great activity, and it incorporates science and math, measuring. And
wow, wonderful. What's that website?
It's at facebook.com/Nick Melvoin.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Nick and Allison, for joining us. This was really a treat. Quite timely. We would have loved to have you at any point, but this especially. And thank you for everything that you're doing for this generation. Thank you for your outlook, your boldness, your ability to create strategy out of, hey, thank you so much for everything that you're doing. Please stay in touch with us. Let us know as things develop. We can help spread the word or just, you know, celebrate the change that you guys are initiating with all the thoughtfulness in the world. Thank you.
Yep.
Thanks for having us. And I know you said at the beginning, but I would not be nearly as effective, if we even can call it that, without Allison. So she runs the show and she's an incredible leader and partner of mine.
You sound like a great team, and we all appreciate you both being there.
And the Palisades wouldn't be the Palisades without Allison.
The biggest disappointment I have in all of this quarantine is that the 4th of July parade is canceled.
Yes.
We'll have to, you know.
Yeah, that's right. That was the news of last week, and it was huge. Yeah, we're bummed out about that. But you know what? The year after, we'll have even more to celebrate. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.